My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who will guide us to Destination Unlimited. We are all human beings. We live in a time when our humanity seems to be tested on an almost daily basis. Recent violent attacks on people of faith from many religions in many lands anger us, sadden us, befuddle us, and leave us asking the eternal question, why? What can each of us individually and collectively do to turn this around, find our common humanity, bring light where there is darkness, and love where there is hate? How may we express in our daily lives the ideal that is found in the basic tenets of virtually every faith, to love our neighbors as ourselves? My guest this week on Destination Unlimited, Rabbi Joshua Hammerman, refers us to the ancient Jewish oral law called the Talmud, which says, "In a world that lacks humanity, be human." Rabbi Hammerman is the spiritual leader of Temple Beth El in Stamford, Connecticut. He's a regular contributor to the New York Jewish Week, the Times of Israel, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and the Religion News Service. His personal essays have appeared in the New York Times Magazine and the Washington Post. He's the winner of the 2018 Religion News Association Award for Excellence in Commentary. He served as the president of the Interfaith Council of Southwestern Connecticut, the Stamford Board of Rabbis, and as chaplain for the Stamford Police Department. He's the author of TheLordIsMyShepherd.com, Seeking God in Cyberspace. He's a rabbi, a journalist, a father, a husband, a Red Sox fan, and an aspiring mensch. He joins me this week to discuss his story and his just-released book, Menschmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. Please join me in welcoming to Destination Unlimited, Rabbi Joshua Hammerman. Good evening, Rabbi.
Good evening, Victor. It's so wonderful to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us, because your story is truly fascinating, what you share so important in our world today. And I know that this book coincides with the 30th anniversary of your tenure at Temple Beth El of Stamford. Congratulations on your wonderful service to that community and to the extended faith communities that you have served. Thank you, sir. Congratulations.
Thank you. And it is such a rarity these days for anyone to stay anywhere for that long, but particularly with clergy who tend to jump around a lot more than than I've had the privilege of having to do here.
Well, when we welcome a guest to this program for the first time, we ask them to share their personal paths. Please tell us about yours and how it led to your ordination as a rabbi.
Well, I grew up the son of a cantor, which is, of course, one of the officiants at Jewish clergy. My father was cantor, actually, for 30 years also at his congregation in Brookline, Massachusetts. And he was the dean of the New England cantorate. He was considered to be a master of his craft with a magnificent voice. And more importantly for me, he was a mensch. He was a person of exemplary quality, whose message to me was to be a mensch. And unfortunately, he passed away very young at age 60 after having served those 30 years. So really much of my life since then has been trying to sort of figure out that relationship and come to some sense of completion with it and with him. So anyway, I grew up as the son of the cantor, but wanted to be a journalist more than anything else. Went off to Brown University from Boston, and then eventually decided that I loved religion. I took several religious studies classes, not Judaism, other religions, and then a little bit of Judaism too. But it was really through the back door that I found my way back to Judaism, having asked all of the ultimate questions that you do when you study all these other religions, including Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, various forms of Christianity. So I came to love religion. And then I sort of jumped into rabbinical school at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, but at the same time maintained my love of journalism, going to New York University downtown. So I was rabbinical student by day and journalist by night, and trying to combine the two into a life that really has sustained me for the decades since. So I guess that's part one of my life story. I don't want to go through the whole thing right now, but well, I'm sure we'll come back to it.
Now, most of our listeners are familiar with the title rabbi, but many are not aware of what it means. What is a rabbi?
Well, a rabbi is a teacher. Actually, the literal translation of the word in Hebrew is great one, but I think that's part of the problem. We tend, and not just rabbis, but other clergy, tend to sort of place themselves on pedestals and tend to believe the press clippings. But it really is a name of respect. So it doesn't really mean we think you're the greatest thing in the world, but we want to treat you with honor because we should treat all teachers with honor. What a rabbi isn't is holier than anyone else. A rabbi is not an intermediary between human beings and God. We, in fact, are, in my estimation, we are fellow travelers. We're not shepherds. We're fellow travelers on this journey. We're taking the journey together. We are fellow human beings. We have a little bit more experience, perhaps, and a little bit more knowledge to share, but it really is a journey that we all take together. So that's what a rabbi is.
And what are the services that a rabbi offers the congregation?
Very much like other clergy. We, of course, do pastoral work, attending to the needs of those who are ill or to those who have lost loved ones. We also do an awful lot of work at times like these when society is in such turmoil, trying to keep our communities together and try to forge, you know, higher purpose, higher sense of purpose when so much is dragging us down. But I give sermons and lead discussions and lead services very much like other clergy.
Now, in your biography, we had mentioned your service as president of the Interfaith Council of Southwestern Connecticut. Please tell us about your experience with the council and the interfaith movement.
I've been very involved in interfaith work, partly, as I mentioned, because of my college background, having had a chance to spend lots of time with people of other faiths. And here in Southwestern Connecticut, we're very fortunate to have representation from so many diverse cultures and faiths. We also have, sort of on the other side of the ledger, a history of some bigotry. I guess that's true anywhere. But here in Fairfield County, you might recall the Gregory Peck movie, Gentleman's Agreement, where Jews were somewhat excluded from society, especially from high society here. So that history is a bit of a stain, but it's been very much made up for over the last few decades. In fact, when I was president of the Interfaith Council, which was several years back, I was the first pulpit rabbi to lead the council. And when you think about it, it covering such communities as Greenwich and Darien and New Canaan and Westport, as well as Stamford, places where there has been some discrimination against Jews in the past, it was quite an honor to be sort of the head clergy of all of these places.
And what were the activities of the Interfaith Council?
We are still very active. But we, in the past, we had some incredible conferences here, including the National Conference of Christians and Jews came here to convene a couple of times. Recently, just last week, I led an interfaith seder with a Muslim imam and a Protestant minister, two people who have become very close friends of mine. And together, I did sort of the Seder part, but we then joined together to have a conversation about different themes related to the holidays, to Passover and Easter, and now Ramadan is coming up too. So we do a lot of interfaith dialogue, and we take it on the road. We go to high schools, we go to churches and synagogues and mosques, and this year, unfortunately, we've been called upon to do an awful lot of work bringing the community together following the horrible tragedies that have affected places of prayer of all the major faiths.
As I had shared with you before we started this interview, I was blessed to attend the New Seminary of New York in the 1990s, which was one of the first interfaith seminaries established in the United States. It was founded by Rabbi Joseph Gelberman, as well as an imam, a couple of ministers of various denominations, an Episcopal priest, and a swami, and various and diverse members of different faith groups. And one of the beautiful things that were part of the curriculum of the New Seminary of New York is that we would take these pilgrimages where the class would go to various houses of worship of different religions, be welcomed there, and experience what those services were like. And what we found in each and every case was that foundationally, it's all the same. Do you find that too?
I think there are an awful lot of similarities. There are a few differences, but the structure, especially between Christianity and Judaism, is similarly based on traditions going back to the Old Testament, or what we would call the Hebrew Bible, the work of the priests back then, which has been continued in different ways by the two faiths, and actually Islam as well. But what's interesting is also the differences. I love some of the differences. Islam is much more involved in choreography, and Judaism, as you know, we Jews like to believe that we're good with words. Well, we have an awful lot of words in our liturgy. In fact, we have pretty bad editors, I think, because over 2,000 years we keep adding and we rarely subtract. So our services just get longer and longer and longer. But the themes are essentially the same, and they're universal. And so much of it comes back to love your neighbor as yourself. Comes back to what in Judaism we call being a mensch, which is exactly why I wrote my book.
And his book is called Menschmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. My guest is Rabbi Joshua Hammerman, and we'll be back with Rabbi Hammerman after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Tune in to The Practical Intuitive, Mind, Body, Spirit for the Real World, with me, host Robin Fritz, Mondays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 Eastern. I'll cover personal and business intuition, animal communication, mediumship, space clearing, past life regression, shamanic insights, energy healing, soul choice, and more, all to help you tap your own intuitive and healing skills. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Why should you volunteer with Meals on Wheels?
I never thought that 5 minutes could make so much difference in the lives of two people, but it has.
Drop off a warm meal and get more than you expect. Volunteer at AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. Brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
You wanted to see me?
Yes, please, have a seat. So here's the thing. When this company brought you on, we took a chance on you. You didn't have that 4-year college degree we typically look for.
Right.
But we gave you a shot anyway. And since then, you've worked incredibly hard and given it your all.
Thanks.
You've been an important asset to the team, but I don't think you can be an intern here anymore. We want to hire you.
You're serious?
Absolutely.
Find your next great employee. Introduce yourself to the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
I won't let you down.
I know.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Rabbi Joshua Hammerman. He's the author of Menschmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. Rabbi, your first book was entitled TheLordIsMyShepherd.com, Seeking God in Cyberspace. What inspired you to write this, and what was the message you were delivering?
Well, I've always been one that assumes Judaism is not disconnected from the real world, and that the way religion can enhance our lives and allow us all to flourish is to connect us to the real world and not to divorce itself from, especially from science. But the internet was, at that time when I wrote it, was like 20 years ago, it was still relatively new, in fact, very new for a lot of people. And the experience of connecting, of profound connection going online, led to what I considered to be spiritual moments, moments of real transcendence and real connection, and of the obliteration of boundaries of time and of space, where I could connect with my sister in Israel instantaneously, and it didn't matter what time it was for either of us. My child's my young son's at bats in Little League could be up right up against the Red Sox, against the Yankees, and it was almost like a complete equality of the two together. So just the unlimited possibilities of the internet were making themselves apparent to all of us at that time. I think now we've come to realize that with those still unlimited possibilities, there are also lots of dangers. So I probably would write a different book now, but I still do believe there are ways to find God online.
And let the surfer beware.
Yes, exactly. But I think we're becoming much more aware by the day.
Now, your new book just came out, is entitled Menschmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. For our listeners not familiar with the word, what is a mensch?
Well, that's exactly the problem. I want listeners to become familiar with the word. Of course, among Jews, it's a word that we use all the time, although primarily at bar mitzvahs and at funerals, when we want to talk about someone who was a good person. But the definition of mensch as a good person is like calling LeBron James a good basketball player, because there is so much more to it. In fact, we say that that Eskimos have 50 words for snow. Mm-hmm. I would say that there are at least 50 things that the word mensch can mean. So it means someone who is kind, someone who is of good character, someone who has self-control, who's humble, who's forgiving, who's fair, who's enthusiastic, who is grateful, who's brave, who's creative. All of these things come together in the term mensch. When we want to say someone is an incredible person, we say mensch. But you don't have to be a saint to be a mensch. That's one thing that's important. You know, when we think of a mensch, we don't have to be thinking of the Dalai Lama. We can think of just the person next door, the guy who goes about his work and his family in an honest and kind way and treats the world as he would want to be treated, loves his neighbor as himself. And there's also one other thing, a couple of other things. One thing, a mensch in German means man. In Yiddish, originally it means man, but it can be a woman. And it doesn't have to be a Jew. So it's important that anyone can be a mensch. The problem is that you first have to understand what it is in order to be one. And the way I try to demonstrate it in my book is not through exposition so much as through example, because that's the way I've taught, the way I've been a clergy, a minister, is through teaching by the example of my own life experience.
Now, you had mentioned using the word mensch at bar mitzvah, but can children be mensches?
Anyone can be a mensch. I know some kids who are wonderful mensches. Here's the other thing, though. If you call yourself a mensch, then you're not one. Because in order to be a mensch, you have to be aspiring to be a mensch. So although I might say of a bar mitzvah, you are a real mensch, and I often say that of someone who has died when I speak in their eulogies, you can't call yourself a mensch. Of course, if you have just died, you're not going to do that anyway. But you want people to call you one. You want people to think of you as a mensch. I think it's something that is very aspirational. And in fact, I've never said in a eulogy at a funeral, he was a billionaire, or he had 10 wives, or she had 10 husbands. It's about not so much what you've acquired or accumulated in life, but the quality of the life you've led.
So menschdom, if I can make up a word or use the word, is a lifelong aspiration.
It is a lifelong project, and yet you can achieve it in the eyes of others. So it's not like you'll never achieve it. It's not like you'll always be climbing this ladder. When you've gotten to a certain point where you have a reputation of honesty and humility, you can achieve it. And once you've achieved it, even if you think of it a little bit in your own eyes, although you don't want to say it out loud, you can do things that otherwise might be very difficult to do. I'll give you an example. As a rabbi, I need to take positions on controversial matters. I have to, especially in these untethered times. You really have to, say this is right and this is wrong, because moral clarity is what people are looking for. On the other hand, people are looking to clergy and community leaders to express civility, to show how we all can get along, no matter what our views, to have the biggest possible big tent. So I've been here 30 years, as you know, in my congregation, and I think I've at least tried to succeed to both have civility and yet have principle and, I guess, chew bubblegum at the same time. You've got to be able to try to do both. Sometimes that's hard to do, but if they know you're a mensch, if they feel you're a mensch and you're doing your best, you're being honest about it and principled, then that's okay. There's one other element that I should mention, in no pun intended. To be a mensch, you also need to be able to be wrong sometimes. You need to be fallible. You are imperfect. And so as a mensch, you try to teach people how to overcome those imperfections, those mistakes. And I've made a few of them in my life and in my career that I cover some of the big ones in the book. Even when I make like a little mistake, I get a page number wrong when I'm announcing a prayer, I'll turn to the congregation and say, I did that intentionally so you could see how I can recover from my, from my fallibility, from my mistakes.
That's wonderful.
That doesn't usually work, but you also have to have a sense of humor, a really good sense of humor.
I think that's mandatory for all mensches, is to be able to laugh, and especially laugh at themselves.
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely.
Now, in the introduction to your book, you share Tiffany Schlain's periodic table of being a mensch that lists 24 yes. qualities of human chemistry. Where does one start on that journey to menschdom?
Well, it's interesting because in the book, in some ways it's a memoir, but I don't go chronologically. I should back up a step and say there are 42 steps on this journey that this book comprises, 42 what I call benchmarks instead of chapters. They're all very brief, maybe 1,000 words. Some of them are a little bit longer, but they're nugget size. And so they come from different parts of my life, especially the last 30 years, but even beyond. But they're not chronological. They're thematic, so that I can show that these different qualities relate to one another. So, for instance, you really need to connect humor and humility. We talked about being self-deprecating. You can't just be humble without a sense of humor. And in order to show leadership, and these are all parts of this periodic table, which was brilliantly done, then it has to interact with honesty and kindness and love of learning and enthusiasm and spirituality, of course. And a lot of that is based on gratitude. I don't know that you can say one quality is more important than any of the others, because they all interact. They all reinforce one another. So in the book, I really try to encourage people to test themselves, to take their own journey, and to find the place of each of these qualities. And they're not just these 24, but any menschlich qualities as they incorporate them into their lives.
Now, you mentioned that you categorized your book into benchmarks, a wonderful paraphrase of benchmarks, stepping stones to spiritual maturity. How did you come up with the name benchmarks?
I think it was probably in my sleep one day. I woke up and say, benchmarks. Because I am a trained journalist as well as a religious leader, words have been my craft from the start. I have one huge advantage over most rabbis and ministers and other clergy in that I know how to edit. so that usually I can refine my ideas down to, you know, palatable nuggets. And I've written a lot of columns, which back in the old days when we were all just in print, they had real word limits. So I'm able to do that. So I wanted to create sort of these little nuggets, as I said, and I said, well, let's call them benchmarks of menschiness. And then I said, oh, well, why not benchmarks? Also, a few years ago, before the Jewish high holidays, I tried to list several of these qualities, actually about 40 of them, because we count 40 days from the beginning of the month preceding the new year all the way through Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So each day I would send out to my congregation one of these exemplary character traits, and I called them benchmarks there too. So that sort of jumped into the idea of the book as it developed.
Can you have a mini benchmark?
A mini benchmark. What would make a benchmark mini?
A little mitzvah.
You know, I think little ones create big ones. So I'm not sure. I like to think that every small act can potentially yield enormous results and resonate down the road. And I know I'm not alone in saying that. It is really a long line of Jewish philosophers and Hasidic leaders, especially, and visionaries, who have looked at the smallest things as leading to enormous results. There are also biblical examples. Maybe I can cite one very quickly. When Joseph went down to Egypt, of course, he was sold into slavery by his brothers at the end of the book of Genesis. But he would never have found out where the brothers were shepherding their flocks unless a certain man, an individual, called an ish, just called a man. Basically, he asked at a gas station on the way to Dothan, where the brothers were, somewhere near Shechem, near what's now Nablus, on his way up to the north. So if that, let's say that gas station attendant hadn't given him the right directions to find his brothers, Joseph never would have gone to where his brothers were. They never, in their enraged state, would have thrown him into the pit and then sold him into slavery. He never would have gone down to Egypt, where he, in turn, was enslaved and then imprisoned and then rose to become second to Pharaoh and eventually saved Egypt and saved his brothers and his family, who then came down to Egypt and they multiplied there, and the rest is history. There would not have been an Exodus or a Ten Commandments had it not been for that one unknown, unnamed man.
And it goes, and it goes. My guest is Rabbi Joshua Hammerman. He's the author of Benchmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. Rabbi, please tell our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about your work.
Well, it is available on Amazon. Benchmarks has a hyphen between the mensch and the marks. Actually, in the book, it's a dot, but I won't get into that. But I have a website as well, which is benchmarks.com. Without the hyphen, just one word, benchmarks.com. And from there, you can find out all about the book. You can read the introductory chapter and link, of course, to Amazon to buy it.
And we'll be back with more of Rabbi Joshua Hammerman and Benchmarks after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
You're listening to OTRFM. Part of the IOM Radio Network.
Humanity Healing International is a small nonprofit with a big dream. Since 2007, HHI has been working tirelessly to bring help to communities with little or no hope. Our projects are not broad mandates, nor are they overnight solutions, but they bring the reassurance that no one is alone and that someone cares. To learn more, please visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Hi, it's Olivia Munn with my shelter pets, Frankie and Chance, reminding you that when you adopt a shelter pet, you discover all the things that make them unique. Adopt pure love at theshelterpetproject.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council, the Humane Society of the United States, and Maddie's Fund.
B- Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Rabbi Joshua Hammerman. He's the author of Menschmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. Just out of curiosity, why did you say human rabbi?
Well, I think the word mensch, for one thing, means human. And I've always, I sort of mentioned at the beginning that I've always seen my role as being a fellow traveler. And one of the most important aspects of being a religious leader for me is to bring things down to their most basic, the basic human level. The first article that I wrote, major article, which is the first benchmark in the first benchmark in the book, was an article for the New York Times Magazine that I wrote when I was 28 years old and was experiencing how people viewed me as a rabbi that was counter to all of their expectations of what a rabbi should look like. Either the fact that I was talking to judges and senators and calling them by their first name, and they were calling me rabbi, and they were twice, maybe more than twice my age. It felt a little strange, but I also understood that they were not really looking at me as a person, but looking at the role that I represent. So I felt it was important to try to break down those barriers, to break down the stereotypes that we have, because although I may not have had the wisdom that a rabbi of my age might have, I had a certain youthful enthusiasm that I think I could bring to my work, and that shouldn't be prejudged as being too young or too fresh or just not ready for prime time. Or whatever. I think that we tend to stereotype everyone, but especially religious leaders, because we bring so much baggage to our views of this, especially our rabbis, our ministers, our imams. We have lots of baggage. So I know that people aren't always looking at me when they're looking at me. And I want to break that down, because if I can break that down in that relationship, then I have a chance of helping those barriers to true human communication break down in every respect. And that has to do with, of course, with race, with gender, with so many other things.
Do you think it would benefit clergy in general to have some type of training or classes in connecting that way of opening the veneer that exists and do veneer, because there's respect involved and admiration for the study and the work that each of the member of the clergy do. But do you think that would be helpful?
I do. I think it's so important. I think we get it over time. And you know, the benchmarks that I describe in the book are real experiences and major dilemmas and crises that I had to face that have given me so much wisdom over time. I'm grateful for them, although they were so painful at the time. But even from the start, you know, when I took my dual course of rabbi by day and journalist by night, I think I learned more about how to be a rabbi and a religious leader from my work in journalism school than I may have learned at the seminary. At the seminary, which was uptown in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, I spent my days studying ancient books, literally in ivory towers. And at night, I was at NYU, and their journalism program is so wonderful because it lets you loose on the streets of New York. So I went to Rikers Island and talked to inmates there. I went to night court and saw the real life things that were going on. I saw homeless people on the streets and tried to interact with them and work with them and did the things that what I consider to be true religious leaders have always done, you know, from Mother Teresa on down. So I think that that's where all religious leaders need to go. And the good news is that I think the training now is leading more in that direction.
You share your story with humility, awareness, and definitely a sense of humor. Tell us about Rabbi Claus.
Well, that was an interesting situation that arose a few years back. I celebrate Christmas every year, you know, and I'm not ashamed to say it, because my congregation has for many years gone to homeless shelters in my community to relieve the non-Jewish workers of their responsibilities for the night so they can be with their families. So we go and help. And so we bring Christmas to these homeless shelters. And one year there was a need for a Santa Claus. And the question came up whether I would be willing to do it. Now, I don't particularly look like Santa Claus, and I looked a little less like Santa then. But I guess anyone can look like Santa Claus if you put on a beard and, you know, a red outfit. But then I sort of went through all of the, all of the psychological issues that would come up for my own children who were pretty young at the time, or for some of the other children, or for some of the Christians at the shelter, you know, wondering whether the rabbi is actually Christian, or all of the questions that would come up, whether it's okay for a rabbi to dress as Santa Claus. In the end, I ended up not doing it, not out of fear, because I put on my rabbi outfit instead, my yarmulke. And then I came to realize that, just as I was talking about before, it's more important not so much what you're wearing on the outside, but the person, the human being that you are within.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful story. Thank you for that. Now, Vice President Biden, who has recently thrown his hat into the ring for the 2020 Democratic nomination for president, had some issues because of his very natural way of hugging and embracing people. You share a very cute anecdote about the importance of human touch. What happened?
Well, on Tuesday, the rabbi got sick. I came down with one of my all-time personal best fevers, and unfortunately, it sounded like I had a fever. So when I left my greeting on my phone, I had to say, oh, by the way, I have the flu. After which I got lots of, you know, very helpful messages from congregants about why didn't you take a flu shot, and, trying to make me feel better in that way when I felt really guilty. The problem was we had a bat mitzvah that weekend. And I find that to be a true religious leader, you know, Joe Biden notwithstanding, and I'm not sure even for politicians, I think it's important to do a little hugging. It's important to have physical contact. The world has become so antiseptic. We've become so paranoid of invisible enemies like germs. My dilemma was, how am I going to deal with trying to be physically close to a congregation? And we do a lot of touching during services, but they all knew I was sick. So we walk around with the Torah, and I'm imagining a scenario where I'm walking around with the Torah. We have this procession. We usually shake hands, and having the person behind me with a dispenser of Purell just to make sure everyone would be safe. You know, maybe I should be like that boy in the bubble and walk around like that. How can you be an effective leader if you can't be close to people? So, of course, the moment of truth was arriving. I'm standing with the bat mitzvah girl, and everyone is thinking, is this horrible beast going to, you know, infect this innocent child just hours from an awesome party? What is he going to do? You know, so in the end, well, maybe I shouldn't give it away. No, I guess I'll give it away because there are a lot of other good benchmarks. In the end, what she, in her wisdom, suggested that we do is that each of us held a prayer book up and we touched prayer books and kissed them as a way of showing, you know, our desire to be close, to be part of one religious tradition together and to share that together and to share a very intimate moment in a very innocent and wonderful way without her getting my cold and my flu.
You share another wonderful chapter entitled Leaping with Angels, dealing with the simultaneous illness of your son and a congregant who was dying. You had to choose between leaving your son in the emergency room and serving your congregant. What happened and what did you learn from this?
Well, this was one of the most traumatic moments of my career. My son, who was a teenager at the time, had to go to the emergency room. It turned out he was okay, but of course at the time we didn't know that. We were very much afraid for him. So my wife and I brought him down to the emergency room. And as soon as we arrived in the emergency room, a congregant came in who had suffered a severe brain injury. Of course, being escorted in, being wheeled in, his wife and two younger children, about the same age as my son, maybe a little younger, came in with him, with the congregant. And it was almost at this point he was very close to death. So here I was in this impossible situation where I had to choose between being a bad parent and leaving my child in his state of extreme crisis, and or a bad clergy, a bad rabbi. I'm in the same room as these congregants suffering the most excruciating, difficult moment of their lives. And how could I not be with them at this difficult time? So the choice was with being bad parent, bad rabbi, or both. And I, as a human being, did not want to make that Sophie's choice. So I chose both. So I was hopping from one gurney to the other, you know, up and down, back and forth. If this had been labor and delivery, it would have been a comedy. But because it wasn't, it was very sad and tragic. What happened at the end, though, really helped me to learn a lot about, you know, what my role is as a rabbi and how really it's to be a human being. The wife of the man who was dying came over to my area, to where my son was, and opened the curtain and peeked in and asked him how he was doing. And I looked at her and I just could not believe at that moment that she could care about my son. And I realized that it wasn't about being the rabbi, being the professional. It was about each of us trying in some way to help one another in an impossible situation. She taught me how to leap with angels.
Wonderful. My guest is Rabbi Joshua Hammerman. He's the author of Menschmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. And we'll be back with more after these words on the Om Times Radio Network.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What Is Going Om? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up. Like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
A ranger station.
I'd like to report a bear hug.
Okay.
I put out my campfire and Smokey Bear hugged me.
So you drowned the fire, you stirred it, drowned it again, and felt that it was cold?
Uh-huh.
Yep, he's just letting you know you did good.
Bear hug from Smokey Bear. Status update.
I'm gonna let you go now. There are many ways to start a fire, but one sure way to put it out. Learn how you can do your part at SmokeyBear.com.
Sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service, Ad Council, and your state forester.
Looking for inspiration?
Want to be inspired?
Not sure where to go?
Find Mark and Kim every Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern on Inspired Living.
Topics will elevate consciousness and range from metaphysics to the human and social experience and all things spiritual.
Welcome to an inspired community that offers support, encouragement, and new ways of thinking. You are the inspired and the inspiration.
Listen, as a hiring manager, I've got to tell you, the best job candidate isn't always the typical candidate. Sometimes they're a grad of life.
Meet the grads of life. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
Sometimes the best candidates aren't the ones you're used to.
Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Back on Destination Unlimited, my guest this evening is Rabbi Joshua Hammerman. He's the author of Benchmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. Rabbi, how do we look at our capabilities and limitations and find a balance?
Well, I think life is all about finding a balance. The major thing we have to be able to do is to aim high, but always forgive our own failings. Give ourselves an opportunity to fail so that we can aim high once again. In one of the chapters, I talk about the notion of hypocrisy, which people have turned into the gravest of sins. In my estimation, hypocrisy is not an enormous sin at all. In fact, the only way you can be a hypocrite is if you set the bar so high that you don't reach it. If you set the bar very low, you know, a thief who professes being a thief is not a hypocrite. So I think hypocrisy is somewhat overrated as a sin. Unfortunately, though, we find a lot of clergy who have been exposed as true hypocrites, and they've done a disservice to all of us. The way to avoid being, being seen as a hypocrite or as someone who is totally corrupt is to apologize. You know, it is to know that you're wrong. Being a mensch is always having to say you're sorry. Mm. In a way, you know, love is the same. It's not really never having to say you're sorry. So if you go in with that attitude, and I certainly apologize an awful lot, and you understand in that humility that every opportunity to make a mistake is also an opportunity to grow, then I think you can find that balance.
With the recent attacks on synagogues, churches, and mosques, it's become apparent that religious intolerance and hatred has emerged, reared its ugly head again. What do you say to your congregants about this, and how should people of faith address this?
Well, after the horrible Pittsburgh shooting last year, we addressed the issue. One issue that kept coming up was whether Jews should turn the other cheek. Famously, the Christian congregation in Charleston, forgave the killer, whereas the Jewish congregation in Pittsburgh wouldn't even have considered forgiving the killer, who certainly has remained unrepentant. And so the issue of turning the other cheek, which Christianity professes, is something that Jews would not necessarily do. But the way to address it, instead of forgiving the perpetrator, is to find a general sense of forgiveness and reconciliation in society. The best revenge against this extremism, against this hate, is to bring together, let's say, the Jewish and Muslim communities, as happened in Pittsburgh, with such gestures of magnanimity on the part of the Muslims. And that was reciprocated when Muslims have been attacked, as they so often have in this country. So it's created a real momentum for interfaith understanding and cooperation, which is an undercurrent of the extremism that unfortunately is much more public and still very prevalent.
What can the average person do to promote kindness in their communities?
Well, I think we all know intuitively what is a kind and good act. I mean, if we need to, we can study the Bible and we can study other sources. But the key is exactly what you're saying, that the individual needs to do it. There was a great Jewish moralist of the 19th century named Rabbi Israel Salanter. And he said, and I use this quote as a sort of a cornerstone in the book. He said, I tried to change the world, and I failed. Then I sort of narrowed my focus. I tried to change my city, and I failed. Then I tried to change my family, and I failed. Then I tried to change myself, and I was able to change the world. Mm. What a beautiful way of looking at it. We're not going to change the world automatically, but we can create a mensch of ourselves, and in doing so, we can save the world one mensch at a time.
Absolutely. That's beautifully said. Thank you. You know, you share your pilgrimage to Sandy Hook a year after the inconceivable violence at Newtown High School. What was that like, and what lessons were learned from that experience?
It was mind-blowing. And I'm less than 30 miles away from Sandy Hook, where I live here in Stamford, Connecticut. And I just felt it was not appropriate. It would be like gawking. It wasn't right. Although I knew some people, and many in my congregation knew people up there, the time wasn't right. So it so happened that one of my 20-somethings was in recovery, and as part of her work, she volunteered to go out and talk to high school students about her journey. Especially regarding alcohol. And so she invited me to come and hear her because I'd worked very closely with her through her journey. So it so happened she was going to be speaking at Sandy Hook High School to ninth graders on the almost the anniversary, a little before the first anniversary of the shootings up there. So I drove up there, and the chapter records almost every inch of that journey and my trepidation. Once I arrive, I was very careful to go to the security people to let them know who I was, and just very conscious of where I was at every moment, looking around me, seeing that it seemed almost unusually the case that parents and their kids were sitting together. You almost never see teenagers, high school students, sitting with their parents in a situation like that, but in an almost overly protective way. And then going through the program, which had the sort of the standard horrific movies and speeches about the dangers of drugs and alcohol, which every teenager needs to hear. And it's horrific. But in the context of where I was, it was like a normal horrific, which every high school in the country might deal with, at least in terms of teaching, as opposed to the once one-of-a-kind horrors that they had endured. And I try to imagine what normal means for a community like that, and how it almost is impossible to return to any real sense of normalcy, no matter how many years pass. And as Jews, you know, I'm familiar with that in some ways because we've been victims so often, and certainly the specter of the Holocaust still is there after even now almost eight decades. We understand what it is to never quite return to normal.
Mm. Mm. Of all the benchmarks, and I know these are stepping stones and building blocks, but of all the benchmarks, would you say there is one that is most important?
Well, I think they're all equally important. But I will say that there is one that probably is the most significant in my having decided to include it in this book. I don't know how many of your listeners will recall, sort of a 15 minutes of shame back in 2011, 2012, when one of my articles articles sometimes tend to have humor, tend to be a little bit on the sarcastic side. And I went a little bit overboard. And speaking of Tim Tebow, the football player, and because of that, it sort of caught on. On the internet, it went viral. It was picked up especially by right-wing media, but then it went mainstream, and I was branded a bigot, which for me, that my life's work had been to build bridges between peoples, and that branding, which was sticking in a real way, was just devastating. So that chapter talks about the journey that I took through those few weeks and months right after that incident. And then, almost a year later, on the high holidays, on Yom Kippur, it contains, almost in its entirety, a sermon that I gave to my congregation. Now, normally my sermons are put online right after the holidays. This one was never published. It was never shared. It was considered by many congregants to be the most important one I've ever given. And I'm privileged to share it now in this book. The lesson that I learned, I mean, I learned many lessons from it, was all about failure. And in my being able to own it and share it with others, and also talk about the path toward repentance and forgiveness, I was able to help many congregants through personal crises that they were facing in their lives and with other people, including loved ones. And because I was able to do that, I was able to sort of rescue some people from the edge. My suffering had a much deeper purpose than had I just tried to rationalize it or issue a quick public relations apology and then move on or try to score political points. And I think that makes that one longer chapter a really important part of the book.
A wonderful lesson, and your entire book is a series of wonderful shares and personal lessons that we can all learn from and grow from. My guest, Rabbi Joshua Hammerman, his book is called Benchmarks, Life Lessons of a Human Rabbi. Rabbi, please tell our listeners one more time where they can get your book and find out more about your work.
Sure. It's on Amazon and at all major bookstores and online booksellers. And my book's website is Benchmarks, one word, Benchmarks, M-E-N-S-C-H. Mensch is spelled a little funny. Benchmarks.com.
Rabbi, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.